finance law bank customer too. Good point. Let's remind ourselves of what we're doing, because it's been so long. Back on page 99, I guess. We're talking about bank and customer relationship, yeah? And we're talking about the nature of the relationship between bank and customer, which was Foley and Hill, Joachimson, about it being a contractual relationship, not a fiduciary relationship in the ordinary course of events. And then Joachimson a bit about some of the implied terms of that contract. And so what we're thinking about is, in situations in which bankers are dealing with their customers, particularly what we're going to start thinking about in more detail today, dealing with cheques where they've been fraudulently converted, altered, and so on and so forth, who is going to bear the liability of the loss when some third-party shyster frauds the thief? Technical legal expression. Amends a cheque and pays the cheque through their bank account and then runs off with the money. Yeah. Is it going to be the customer that's going to bear that loss, or the account holder? Or should it be one of the banks involved in that process? You know, the bank that pays out on the cheque, the bank that receives the money on the cheque. Who is responsible for spotting these sorts of things? Okay. So at some level, part of what we're doing, I suppose, is very close to fraud. You know, we talked about fraud law earlier in the course. But we're thinking particularly about these bankers' responsibilities. And so what we started talking about last time, and if you have a look at the questions you've got in your seminar, and the question on all of this on the specimen exam paper, yes, guided by the specimen exam paper, you will see that there's stuff there, for example, about bankers' confidentiality. What if an employee of a bank says something, divulges information about one of their customers? Whether it's about the amount of money in their account, the things they might be doing in their private life, where their money's coming from, all those kind of things. There is a duty of confidentiality on a banker. And so the bank will be liable to compensate its customer if it breaches that duty. And it's in Tournier and National Provincial Union Bank of England that we get the exceptions to this duty of confidentiality. So what you're doing, the problem answering is, bank teller, for example, divulges information to what we talk about in some of these cases. There was the gambling wife, wasn't there? Sutherland and Barclays Bank. Well, your wife's using all this money to try and pay gambling debts, that's why we wouldn't clear the cheque. Should the bank be liable then to the wife? Does she have a right to insist on the duty of confidentiality? One of the things we're going to talk about, is there a right to bring a claim for defamation? Because a lot of these banking cases, actually, what the claimant is saying is, you have slandered me by telling someone that I've got gambling debts, by telling someone that's where this money's going. What if a bank employee speculates on whether or not the customer is actually involved in drug running or money laundering or something of that sort? You know, we talk about money laundering, and we talked about freezing accounts, and that's what a bank might do. Well, what if, you know, one of the customer's business partners rings up and says, why hasn't this cheque cleared? And they say, oh, it's been frozen. There's something on the account, it's been frozen. I presume it's a money laundering thing, that's what that usually means. You know, if that's divulged, and this is the kind of stuff that people say on the phone, you go to a bank branch, it doesn't tell you anything. You know, in that circumstance, then, you know, is that defamation? A lot of the cases, yes. So that's what a lot of the claims are in cases like Tournier and Sutherland. These people say basically they're being defamed by their bank, which is fun. So that's a big part of what we're talking about there. Confidentiality, rights of compensation, defamation. On page 101, we're then coming on to think about bank mandates and payments. Mandate, if we recall, is an instruction to give a bank to make a payment, or to do some action, or do something on your behalf. The particular aspect, sorry, my voice is really not doing very well today, under 2.2, the particular aspect that we pulled out of all of that is, again, this question, who is going to be liable for any loss that flows? So London, John Stock Bank and Macmillan, 1918, tells us, if the customer draws the cheque, in a manner which facilitates fraud, he's guilty of a breach of duties between himself and the banker. And he will be responsible to the banker for any loss sustained by the banker as a natural and direct consequence of this breach of duty. So one possibility is that we are going to impose liability on the customer in circumstances in which the customer fails to look after their checkbook or their internal processes appropriately. So in London Joint Stock Bank and Macmillan, we have a firm which is one of the bank's customers. And one of their clerks had worked for a long time as what's described by the House of Lords, I always think rather quaintly, as a confidential clerk, meaning he was employed in one of those sensitive money checkbook handling bits of the business. Okay. And this person had worked perfectly properly for a good long time. And he approached one of the partners, basically as the partner was leaving. And the impression that one gets from the facts is that he had just lain in wait and thought, right, I'm going to thieve money, basically. I'm going to wait till one of the partners is on his way out. Yeah? And the usual way, I'll get him up to sign one of these checks. Usual way this firm did business was that this particular clerk, a confidential clerk, would fill out the check and then get the partner to sign it. Partners don't fill out checks. Far too important. So he'd waited until he knew this guy was in a hurry, had to get out to a meeting, and said, oh, could you sign this cheque? The cheque wasn't quite filled out as it usually was for the usual amount. It was filled out for a slightly different amount. But the partner said, well, why is this for £2 rather than the usual £3? He said, oh, it's just this particular instance is different, Mr. Partner. So the partner just signed it. Oh, God, I haven't got time for this, and rushed off. What the employee then did was to alter the cheque. Remember, it's his handwriting that filled it out in the first place, to make it out for a much bigger amount. It's a bit looking like it's being made out for £2 in old money. He makes it out to 120 by putting a 1 and a 0 in either side of the original figure. Then goes off, presents the cheque in the usual way at the bank on behalf of the firm, takes the money and disappears. It was held by the House of Lords that the firm was in breach of what's referred to as its special duty to the bank, to ensure that the way in which it manages its business is appropriate. So they're not making it possible, or easy even, for ordinary employees to defraud the bank, take checks in this sort of manner. And that here, it's because they hadn't got a proper procedure in place that this clerk was able to do what the clerk did. Far too slack. The clerk just fills the stuff in, the partner just signs it, you know, doesn't really think about it. So that's the kind of situation we're talking about. When are we going to start imposing liability on the customer? When is liability going to be kept for the bank? So other cases like London Intercontinental, which we're kind of way down the handout, and Barclays Bank from 1980. Fairly straightforward situation. Just because there's fraud involved doesn't mean that it's the bank's responsibility to check what's going wrong. Here we have a check which is filled out in excess of someone's authority, but that person was one of the signatories, and therefore it was held, well, this person's perfectly entitled to sign this check, he's one of the signatories on your signatory list, and therefore the bank hasn't done anything wrong in passing and paying out on this cheque. And the same idea comes out of Simmons and Barclays Bank from 2003. Interesting, I put this case on because it always makes me laugh. The Grosvenor Casinos and National Bank of Abu Dhabi from 2008 is a fun one. It's a casino. I'm trying to get the numbers right. I always forget the numbers in this one. Mr. Justice Flow, we have some in the region of about 99 million quid is gambled at a casino over time. I mean, that's a heavy weekend, yes. Even for some of you, yeah, I would have thought. That's a big weekend there. The individual had losses of $18 million. pounds, I beg your pardon, £80 million. Same thing, at the minute, almost. And one of the ways in which he was going to pay for these losses...
What, 18 million?
What would you want to say? He has two bearer cheques, okay, in the total of £6 million. Now, the bearer cheques are supposed to be... They're effectively like, you know, £3 million banknotes, yeah? The bearer cheques, whoever has them, could just hand them over to whoever it is, and they're able to present them at their bank and get payment. It's as though they're an enormously valuable banknote, okay, these bearer cheques. The arrangement between, let's just call this person the gambler, the customer, and the bank, is that these cheques will be honoured. So, the gambler hands them over to the casino, saying, there you are, there's 6 million of it. You know, I'm going off to drink absinthe and do something else first of the evening, or watch a film or something, and I've lost 18 million quid. The casino then, of course, tries to pay the cheques into its account. Its bankers go to the bank, the gambler's bank that's produced these bearer cheques, and says, you want payment? And they say, no, this is clearly just gambling, and we're not going to pay out these bearer cheques. The casino then proceeds against the gambler's bank and says, we were told that you would honour these bearer cheques. We've presented them at our bank and apparently are not making payment. We demand compensation. And the gambler's bank said, no, we've got no contractual relationship with you and we're not honouring these things. Court held, quite right, there's no contractual nexus between the casino and the gambler's bank. So the gambler's bank owes no obligations to the casino. It does to its customer, but not to any third party. Okay, so one of the things we get out of some of these cases is that these mandates and the payment obligations are just between banker and customer. They don't extend to third parties as well. It's a very difficult situation if they had been actual banknotes, of course. You know, because they're accepted as ordinary currency, but the fact that these are bearer cheques makes them something different. Because otherwise, under heading 2.4, if a bank repudiates a cheque in the ordinary course of events, then the bank will owe liabilities to pay compensation to its own customer. So we get this from Lord Birkenhead, Wilson and United Counties Bank from 1920. The refusal to meet the cheque under such circumstances is so obviously injurious to the credit of the trader that the latter can recover without allegation of special damage reasonable compensation for the injury done to his credit. So, in an ordinary situation, you're a trader. Yes. You're making payments to one of your suppliers and your bank refuses to honour the cheque. In that situation, clearly, your suppliers are going to think, we're not doing business with them anymore. Obviously, their credit isn't good. Their cheques bounce. Yeah? Put it in the ordinary parlance. So it's likely that people will stop doing business with you if you simply can't make payments. Hey, look what happened to Lehman Brothers, yes? Once people think you can't make payments, you suddenly don't have good credit anymore, no one wants to deal with you. In those situations, Wilson United Counties Bank, the bank owes a liability to compensate its customer. So you've got to show that what your reasonable entitlement to reasonable compensation is in that circumstance. What is it that you've lost? Okay. As ever with these things, you've got to demonstrate loss. You've got to be able to prove what it is you've lost. So if, for example, as a result of a cheque bouncing or a bank refusing to perform its mandate, you lose business, if you can prove that's a direct result, one thing flows from the other, then you'll be entitled to compensation on that basis. And now we get this from London Joint Stock Bank and Macmillan, which I think gives us a lot of the detail on, again, fraud and forged payment instructions. If you look at the Christman exam question and some of your seminar questions, there's quite a lot of focus on this. You remember some of this, I think, from last time. The relation between banker and customer is that of debtor and creditor, yes? Not fiduciary, not proprietary. With a superadded obligation on the part of the banker to honour the customer's cheques if the account is in credit. So assuming you're in credit, one day you might be. Assuming you're in credit, juggling those little letters DR all the time. Assuming you're in credit, then there's an obligation on the banker to pay out on your cheques. Okay, to honour your cheques, not to bounce them. We'll talk about the clearing system in a second. A cheque drawn by a customer is in point of law a mandate to the banker. Bless you, coughing, Steve. A cheque drawn by a customer is in point of law a mandate, an instruction to the banker to pay the amount according to the tenor of the cheque. Yeah? As opposed to it actually being a tenor. It is beyond dispute that the customer is bound to exercise reasonable care in drawing the cheque to prevent the banker being misled. So that's the corollary. The banker has an obligation, if you're in credit, to honour the cheque. Okay. So the bank is supposed to pay it. And then the question is, of course, well, what if it's forged? So the obligation then is on the customer, according to Lord Finlay, to take reasonable care, quote unquote, in drawing the cheque to prevent the banker being misled. If he draws the cheque in a manner which facilitates fraud, for example, letting your confidential clerk run around filling the cheques in and just getting the partner to sign them as he's rushing out the door, then he is guilty of a breach of duty as between himself and the banker. And he will be responsible to the banker for any loss sustained by the banker as a natural and direct consequence of this breach of duty. It has been often said that no one is bound to anticipate the commission of a crime. Unless you live in my view. And that to take advantage of blank spaces left in a cheque for the purpose of increasing the amount is forgery, which the customer is not bound to guard against. It has been suggested that the prevention of forgery must be left to the criminal law. I am unable to accept any such proposition without very great qualification. Everyday experience shows that advantage is taken of negligence for the purpose of perpetrating frauds. As the customer and banker are under a contractual relation in this matter, it appears obvious that in drawing a cheque, the customer is bound to take usual and reasonable precautions to prevent forgery. A crime is indeed a very serious matter, but everyone knows that crime is not uncommon. Brackets here in my end, close brackets. If the cheque is drawn in such a way as to facilitate or almost to invite an increase in the amount by forgery, if the cheque should get into the hands of a dishonest person, forgery is not a remote but a very natural consequence of negligence of this description. And so tease out there, the banker ordinarily then has to honour cheques when you're in credit. But you have to take, as a customer, reasonable care in drawing the cheque. Okay, so in filling it out and presenting it, sending it to whoever it is. And then, top of page 102, the standard is that you are bound to take usual and reasonable precautions. So the facts in front of you suggest you need to be looking at the situation, thinking, well, are these reasonable precautions? If you're in a corporate organisation, like in the McMillan case itself, have you got an appropriate procedure in place for how cheques need to be presented and signed? Are they just filled in by one clerk and signed by one partner? Is that enough? Or do you need them countersigned? Do you need an account system in place now where you decide cheques of how much a value can be signed? If they're above a given value, does somebody else need to countersign them as well? Yeah, how are they produced? How are they drawn? These days with computer systems, of course, it's much easier to put these kind of things in place. Something that jumps out at me as being odd from all of this is at the bottom of page 101, everyday experience shows that advantage is taken of negligence for the purpose of perpetrating frauds. And what I think is fun is that the liability ultimately is that somebody has fraudulently forged a cheque or fraudulently altered a cheque. And liability for that seems to be being fixed on the customer, on the basis of the customer's negligence. And something just strikes me as being a bit odd here, that we have a particular test for fraud, if you remember in Derry and Peake, knowing that something isn't true or being reckless as to whether it's true or not. But suddenly your mere negligence as a customer will fix you with the liability for compensating for all the loss that flowed from that fraud. seems to be somehow you're becoming liable for fraud at one remove simply by being negligent, and that always feels to me as though it's a bit cockeyed. The question for us, I think, in the 21st century, is how should all this law apply now? Because we're in a world of computers. Yes, some of you have got computers. Where computer records are kept. Where it's not this old-fashioned word of drawing a cheque. Yes? Of the cheque being some magical thing that's kept locked in a safe somewhere. But instead, payments are being made much more easily across the internet. In your business, you'll probably be making payments in and out a lot. You'll have direct debits, standing orders, all these kind of mandates and instructions to your bank. Now, we have to start thinking about, you know, where should we, number one, start fixing the liability now? Is this a situation in which it seems more sensible for us to be fixing liability on the banks, because they're the professionals and they can manage these systems better? You've probably had, I certainly have, those phone calls from one of your credit card companies to tell you, oh, there's something strange, you bought two things from Amazon in the same day, what the hell are you doing? Yeah, that shoes and a t-shirt, how dare you live at this place, account for yourself. You know, you get that phone call, you think, oh, God, what the hell's going on there? You know, they've got the software, they've got the facilities to be able to do this, why aren't they the ones that are bearing all this liability? If they're the ones that can watch for oddities in our payment systems. Because the fact that we do all this stuff online, if you bank online and you get some spyware on your computer there, then someone's able to read your passwords, apparently. You know, so you've got no idea what's going on in your bank account, probably as you're sleeping innocently in your bed, or sleeping not innocently in your bed. You know, who knows what's going on? So, is it still appropriate to say this is all fixed on the customer? Or do we just have to rethink what we mean by fixing the customer with an idea that they have to take usual and reasonable precautions? For example, if you're using the internet to buy things, and we've mentioned this last time, internet, you've probably heard of it, yeah? If you are loaded onto a site, somebody wants something for their birthday, and you find the site, and they say, type in your credit card details, and you pause for a minute, and you type them in anyway, and you fill in that little security number on the back, which is going to make all the difference. At that moment, what's the usual precaution you should be taking? We just don't know where this is going to go. We don't know where the law is going to go in this area. Hence, this is a fun area to ask problems in, because we say, well, that's the test. And what do we think in the modern world? Okay. On the one hand, do we say it's enough that you've got McAfee or Norton or one of those kind of anti-spyware systems on your computer? Is that the usual precaution? Is that the reasonable precaution we would expect from you as a customer? Contrarywise, should the bank be able to say, if you don't have that kind of software, or if it's not up to date, you haven't run your live update and done a full, you know, full system scanner if it's called, and gone out for 4 hours while it's going on and then come back again. You know, if you haven't checked and there's no spyware on there, again, have you failed to discharge your obligations? Who knows? Who knows whether this is? You know, who knows what it means to say you've got to take the usual and reasonable precautions? If you bought an Apple Mac as opposed to a Windows PC, and you believed all the adverts that they don't get viruses and software, and you never bother with any of that kind of stuff, again, was that a reasonable precaution? I bought a Mac, I thought that was protected. Yeah, there's that Mitchell and Webb advert all over the tube station, told me it was fine. Is that a reasonable precaution? I have no idea. But I mean, this is the debate, you know, is that a reasonable precaution to do that? Is that you acting reasonably? So there's the question of where should we put the obligation anyway, because the bank is probably much better able to spot somebody in Nevada which isn't gambling on your credit card while you're asleep. Or what is it that you as a customer have to do? If you're, you know, handing in your credit card details to a website you know nothing about, you know, have you gone beyond taking reasonable precautions? Whereas if it's something like Amazon that everyone's heard of that seems to be all right usually, you know, is that okay? Discuss, who knows? So, reasonable precautions. There's a lot to talk about, and just to talk about, you know, where should the balance lie? Who's better able to bear all this? Because otherwise, all these cases really are quite aged. For example, Société Générale and Metropolitan Bank from 1873 note. It kind of goes the other way from Macmillan. In that, we have someone who gets a hold of a cheque, that's been validly made out for £8. Yes. And it says, in words, £8 on the cheque, good old-fashioned stuff. Yeah. This is before we had numbers, you know. And simply added the letter Y to the end of 8, turned it into 80. This is back in the 19th century, that was a lot of money. And suddenly is able to get a hold of £80 on cashing the cheque rather than the 8 that the cheque had been originally made out for. That, by my maths, is about £72 more than you're entitled to. On that basis, it was held that it would be unreasonable to expect that the bank would have spotted that this cheque had been tampered with. Because one letter has been added, that wouldn't have jumped out, and therefore the bank shouldn't be liable to make good this loss. Indeed, no one on those facts, it was thought by the court, could have spotted the difference, simply because the letter Y had been added. So that one I always think is fun. What else have we got? Oh, tying cotton. That's always a fun one. Here we have, again, an accounts clerk, who this time forged the signature of the managing director. Rather than getting the actual signature of the partner on the way out, forged the signature of the managing director. And it's a cheque for an amount of 5.5 million Hong Kong dollars. I don't know what the exchange rate was in 1986, but 5.5 million of anything, that sounds like a lot. And the bank paid out under the cheques. The customer realised later, of course, that they'd all been fraudulently drawn, because this accounts clerk had forged the managing director's signature, and so the customer sought to recover the amount paid out of this bank account from the bank. Yeah? You cleared these cheques, you owe us 5.5 million Hong Kong dollars. The bank's argument was that the company's internal control systems just weren't adequate. If they'd allowed this accounts clerk to have access to cheques in this way, so that he was able to fill them in and sign them himself, then that wasn't a decent internal control procedure. The bank therefore came to claim that the customer owed duties to it to make sure that it had proper internal procedures and systems, and therefore that it, the bank, bore no obligation to compensate its customer in these circumstances. Two things were found by the court in relation to the customer's obligations. The first obligation which the customer bore was an obligation to exercise due care when preparing cheques, not to permit fraud. So you have to exercise due care. And secondly, if you discover that there has been fraud, you have to notify your bank. But there are no more obligations on the customer than that, says the court in Taiping. There is therefore no positive obligation to have appropriate internal procedures and controls. You don't have to have an internal audit system, for example, which is there to seek out fraud. So that might take us back, well, take us on in the corporate system, take us back to what we were talking about before with making payments over the internet, for example. Again, you know, what's appropriate there? If there's no positive obligation on you to watch out for fraud or seek out fraud, then maybe there's nothing you're required to do. Maybe you don't even need to install Norton. Maybe you don't need to go and buy a Mac. In the corporate system, you know, this is a big let-off for corporate entities. I mean, from sort of Macmillan, you know, one would wonder if the law was going to progress in an area where there is a need on you to have a proper system internally. And you think most decent companies would try and do this, that you would try and ensure in the accounts department that there's a limit to who can get access to payment systems, and that more than one person needs to certify that a payment can be made or countersign a cheque or whatever it may be. And you organise a particular time in the week when that will be done, not when the partner's rushing out the door.
So there isn't a huge amount of case law in this area, and none of it seems to quite fit into a net for me, I have to say. excuse me. All right. What are the bank's duties then in relation to money being taken from clients' accounts in this way or others, which builds on the same ideas, I think? We have attention clearly, as we've already said, between whether or not we impose the obligation on the bank to spot fraud, on the one hand to honour checks, but to keep a weather eye open for anything that's being done fraudulently or naughtily, not a legal word, or do we put all the obligation on the customer? Now, in Graham Johnston, 1868, Lord Cairns gives us something that I think still sort of sings out in the law a bit, an idea that what we mustn't do in banking law is to produce a test that's going to be too onerous for banks, or otherwise will make the conduct of banking business really quite difficult. So kind of a standard in the background is that we mustn't make it too difficult for bankers. In 1868, you know, a world in which banks are introducing cheques and bills of exchange payment and mechanisms on paper. It was all done in ledgers. It was all done with old-fashioned fountain pens and quill pens and whatever else. And maybe, you know, spotting these things was either easier because fewer people had bank accounts, and therefore we might think it reasonable for bankers to be able to keep an eye and spot this kind of thing, or more difficult for banks to do because they didn't have computers, they didn't have Sentinel software or whatever it is that most bankers, MasterCard always talk about them using, and whatever it is Barclaycard use, other systems that was available. You know, do we say that actually now it's got easier for bankers because they have all this stuff available too? The big debate about where should we impose that liability, but Lord Cairns is very clear that we mustn't interfere with ordinary banking business by putting the test too high so that bankers are going to want to scrutinise carefully every single cheque in the world. Okay? Otherwise nothing is going to happen. But let me try and explain roughly how cheques clear. This is going to involve a whiteboard. Good heavens. In effect, you know, you've heard of the internet and everything can be done instantly. You know, you can get onto Amazon at 3 o'clock in the morning and, you know, very liberating because you're in your pyjamas and you can buy stuff. The next morning you think, why on earth don't I want a CD by Dido, whatever it is. And if you're buying CDs by Dido, then just give up on life. Which one of these is going to work better? What happens is, you do that, and yet, if you send a cheque off to someone, it still takes 3 days to clear, yes? The internet, you can buy Dido CDs instantaneously, you can regret them almost instantaneously across the internet, but cheques still take 3 days to clear. Well, here's what happens. You've got you, yes? You're looking thin. So thin with throwing things on the floor. And let's suppose you bank with Mammoth Bank. You're with Mammoth Bank, and you write a cheque. Yes, you write a cheque to Dido. You love Dido, you want to pay money out immediately. and so you send a cheque to Dido. Okay. Why does that turn out to be under green pen? I've got a red cap and it's just a fool. Dido banks with... praying for Death Bank. There will be one there. They'll probably have a client first. Now, you send a cheque to Dido. What happens then is, Dido, of course, tries to pay that cheque into her account with Praying for Death Bank, yes? Praying for Death Bank then needs to go to Mammoth Bank and say, we've got a cheque from your customer. Yeah. We want you, please, to transfer the money to us that's the amount that's on this cheque. So you've written Dido a cheque for £40,000 because you love her,
And she's paid the cheque into her account, praying for Death Bank, and then says to Mammoth Bank, we want a payment of £40,000 from you. Okay? And that happens for every single cheque. Okay? Every single bank in the world, if they're taking these cheques, in every business day, going to every other bank in the world and saying, we've got all these cheques from your customers, can you make us a payment on all of these? And they turn around, Mammoth Bank turns around to praying for Death Bank, and say, oh, while you're here, we've got a bunch of cheques too. Yeah? What actually happens in the world now, I've run out of coloured pens, oh, it's going to be red, is that we have so-called clearing banks. You've maybe heard that expression. Where the clearing bank stands in the middle for all of the banks in the system. And instead of Frankfurt F Bank going to Mammoth Bank and going to Barclays and going to Lloyds and going to NatWest and wherever else, instead all the cheques come in to the clearer. And the clearer then looks across and sees how many cheque, well, what amount in sterling across all these cheques is praying for Death Bank required to pay across to Mammoth Bank, and how much in sterling is Mammoth Bank's customer supposed to pay across to praying for Death Bank, and then you set those amounts off. Okay? So at the end of that particular period, we decide that there's £1.2 million in total to be paid by praying for Death Bank to Mammoth Bank. And at the end of that period, there's £1.5 million worth of cheques to come from Mammoth Bank to be paid for praying to the Death Bank. We actually set that off and just say £300,000 should come from Mammoth Bank net to praying for Death Bank, and then we cancel off all those obligations and all those cheques. But as part of the clearing bank process, all those cheques are supposed to be checked. This is why it takes 3 days. Because Mammoth Bank and praying for Death Bank's people are basically trying to spot cheques where there's something funny. So this is why it becomes difficult to talk about cheques in the world. You think the volume of cheques there are in the universe, and why banks were quite so keen to go towards credit cards, debit cards, chip-in pin and all that kind of stuff, is that it takes the pressure out of this system and all of these cheques. Hence 3 days. It's because it has to go through all of this process of checking the cheques, if you pardon the expression, and then netting all those amounts up across the same period. Okay. So that's why we talk about praying for Death Bank, presenting the bank the cheque to Mammoth Bank for clearing, and Mammoth Bank maybe saying no, because they think something funny with the cheque, or some of these old cases, it looks like it's a gambling debt, we're not going to honour that kind of cheque, we think we're just paying book workers. So that's what's going on in the background with a lot of these cases. And so that's why Lord Cairns and Graham Johnston is saying, well, let's not make this too difficult, because this is complicated enough. Yeah? It's complicated enough. Without us needing to start saying that banks are supposed to spot everything. Because then they're going to take even longer looking at the checks, and the system will become even slower. We get some fun ideas. Selangor Rubber Estates and Craddock. Because the question then is, I'm kind of flowing on from all the discussions we've had about knowledge and whatever else. You know, what basis do you then say, well, a bank should have realised or should have known something wrong with the cheque? And we get the idea in Selangor that we shouldn't treat bankers as being detectives. The same idea that we had from McMillan and Bishopsgate in effect from ages ago. Yes. It's not an obligation on bankers in the ordinary course of events clearing cheques to expect they're going to spot things. So, somebody simply putting Y on the end of 8 and turning it into 80 isn't something we'd expect someone to spot. Yeah. But perhaps if it had been written in an entirely different pen, yeah, starts out in a blue biro and someone then in a black felt tip starts putting the Y on the end and changing the signature, and possibly changing the payee. Yeah, if you ever look at the problem question, I think in seminar materials, remember rightly, you know, if someone changes the name and the payee to a vaguely similar name which happens to be their name, again, you know, how obvious should it be? You're supposed to initial changes from everywhere else in cheques. But if your handwriting's like most normal people's, it would be slightly different depending on your mood. You know, and you think, oh, that's almost my signature. You know, at what point should the bank spot? Discuss. And Carrick, Carrick Rubber and Burden, Nevertheless, we're told that there is a duty of skill and care we can expect from bankers. We're not going to expect they're going to act like detectives and spot everything. But we do expect a level of skill and care from them. In that particular case, we have fraudsters who are involved in a takeover. They're trying to take over a company. What they did was that they stole money through fraudulently converting payments from the company they were planning to take over and used that money in part of the takeover process themselves. Yeah. Brass neck. Yeah. We're going to take over this company, we're going to steal this company's money to do it, yeah? And that's nothing at all like the way in which Manchester United was taken over, yes? It's the complete opposite. So, in that situation, the court held that because there was a very large amount of money involved, enough to take over a company, that was an amount which should have jumped out to a bank. Yeah. A cheque for £3.50, maybe not a cheque, a much larger amount, is far more likely the sort of thing a bank should spot. And therefore, in that situation, the banker's duty of care and skill should have meant that it should have spotted that there was a forged payment instruction being used. So again, depends on the context. Now the cases latterly have reined this in a lot, because that seemed to be getting broader. And sorry, to finish off Selangor, it's exactly the same point which LSU and Donna Landholmes have made a while ago. We're not going to impose a positive obligation on bankers, but a bank will be deemed to have knowledge of anything that one of its employees had knowledge of. We will attribute, in banking situations far more readily, the knowledge of an employee to the corporate entity. And that seemed to be reaching a high watermark in Selangor, and a lot of people were quite uncomfortable about how high Selangor pitched that. A couple of cases in the 1990s, Barclays Bank and Quincare and Lipkin Gorman and Cartmel in the Court of Appeal, not the House of Lords, where we looked at it last year in Lord Property 2, although the same case. Lord Justice May held the following, and this wasn't anything that was appealed to or doubted by the House of Lords. For my part, I would hesitate to try to lay down any detailed rules in this context. In the simple case of a current account in credit, the basic obligation of the banker is to pay his customers' cheques in accordance with his mandate. Having in mind the vast numbers of cheques which are presented for payment every day in this country, whether over the bank counter or through the clearing system, it is, in my opinion, only when the circumstances are such that any reasonable cashier would hesitate to pay a cheque at once and refer it to his or her superior, and when any reasonable superior would hesitate to authorise payment without inquiry, that a cheque should be paid immediately on presentation and such inquiry made. So what we have to ask, according to Lord Justice Parker, is whether or not a reasonable and honest banker knew of the relevant facts. So Lord Justice May, taken by all the books to be the standard statement of what the bank's obligations are in the modern context, whereas Selangor and Carrick looked like it was going to raise the banker's level of liability, Lord Justice May is expressing this in terms of your obligation as a banker is to honour cheques. And it's only if there's something about that cheque or about that circumstance where the circumstances are such that any reasonable cashier would hesitate to pay that suddenly the bank should bear a liability. So in effect, what you're asking, if you're thinking about the bank's liability, when there's been a forged payment instruction, a forged cheque or something of that sort, is to ask, well, is there something about the situation, given the volume of cheques that there are being cleared all the time, which would have made a reasonable cashier think there was something wrong? Something that would make a reasonable cashier hesitate, there's a fun word, and refer it to a superior. Mr. Jenkins, what do you think about this one? So that seems to be our test as far as we've got it. Goodo. So that's really what you're asking yourself. Yeah. Who's going to bear the liability? On the one hand, should it be the customer? So has the customer complied with the customer's Macmillan obligations? Or should the bank bear the liability? And as we can see, across Macmillan, Selangor Carrick on the one hand, Quincare and Lipkin Gorman on the other, we seem to have different understandings about how we phrase that test. But it seems to be a test of what would a reasonable bank cashier think about the situation, and is there something about it that would make it stand out?
Okay. So if it's for a large amount of money, like Macmillan, or like in Carrick,
if it's for a smaller amount of money, like in SocGen and Metropolitan Bank, and that seems to be what's going to make a difference. Okay. Totally good. And who knows with internet transactions? I think that becomes the 21st century problem. What if you're doing things online? Yeah. And then there are all kinds of other situations that haven't come up in the cases. For example, you know, if you employ an agent to do stuff on your behalf. Yeah. Carolyn Quentin, who was the actress in Men Behaving Badly and all those kind of things, she was one of a number of people that got done by their accountant. She used an accountant to manage all her business affairs, to make sure all her monies were got in when she did some work, to pay a tax for her and then hold the rest and invest some of her money. And then she lost about £500,000 or something, hundreds of thousands, because her accountant just spent the money, kept the money, dissipated the money, and Carolyn Quentin didn't get it. It's quite a world in which someone could have that amount of your money, basically, and you don't know. So I'm sneezing, allergic at the very idea. So in those kind of situations, another thing we might ask is, if you have someone that's acting on your behalf, doing all that kind of business for you, at what point does it become unreasonable for you as a customer to give that person all your checkbooks, authority to do all your banking business for you, and if they then spirit all your money away, is that your fault, or should the bank spot there's something wrong? If that person starts filling in checks on your behalf and forging your name, at what point should a reasonable banker spot something's going on? If there's huge amounts of money involved, clearing out all your accounts of hundreds of thousands of pounds, maybe that's crossed the threshold in cases like Macmillan and Carrick. Whereas if it's just small amounts that are taken out on a regular basis, is it even less likely a bank should be liable? If this accountant, for example, takes out £100 a week, looks like a small amount of money, and also if they're doing it regularly and nobody spots, then actually it's more likely a bank could say, well, you've been doing this for ages, why would we have thought there's anything wrong? Because you're paying out this amount of money on a regular basis. So again, all you're being asked to do is to look at the factual scenario and think, well, what do I think is reasonable here? And should it be the customer, or should it be the banker that bears the loss? Okay. Ultimately, we're saying, if the money's gone out of the customer's account, the customer bears that loss, or the bank has got to compensate the customer by putting the money back in. By putting the money back in, I'm not a property lawyer, am I? By putting an equivalent amount of money back in the account. And so that's how we talk about who's suffering loss and who isn't. I think I'll do for today. What we're going to do tomorrow then is to pick up Barclays Bank and Sims and then talk about payment methods a bit. Now, have a look at the problem questions in the seminar on the specimen exam paper. It's all this kind of stuff we're talking about. I think it's, nice straightforward cases of what you think is the best approach. Very good. A quick DVD show for those of us staying home.